Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International, the first program for 2019. Happy New Year to you all. Anti-violence campaigners in the Pacific say a program which uses men as role models is best practice and should be shared with the rest of the world. The Pacific Women's Network has been meeting in Fiji this month and have called for more men to stand up for women's rights. Christina Ravoi has more.
Surveys show that two-thirds of Pacific women and girls have experienced violence by an intimate partner or family member. Papua New Guinea has the highest rate of 70%, with Solomon Islands and Kiribati not far behind. Ofa Kudunpil Likiliki of the Pacific Women's Network says, despite the rising rates, its male advocacy program is working.
I think it's a program or a model that should be shared with the rest of the world because it's homegrown. It was developed by Pacific men and women, and it speaks to our context.
The program was started more than 10 years ago. One of the first male advocates, Melky Anton from Papua New Guinea, says it's based on very strong principles of human rights. But he says it's been challenging to change attitudes.
It's not easy this shift because of the social and cultural norms that exist in our Pacific culture, where men are holding on to very strong patriarchal attitudes that is supported by inequalities that you find in the church and religion as far as male domination is concerned.
Mr. Anton says because the program's homegrown, it has had a better chance of success than overseas design programs.
Men have actually realized their own violence, including me, when I started in this program, on how I may not be physically violent to women, but in the way I speak, in the way I control or intimidate, that can also be included as part of violence.
Another male advocate, Fijian Tura Lewai, says the advocates around the region have varied backgrounds but with one common goal.
There are a lot of privileges that are accorded to us just by being born a man. We work on influencing through our work in our different spheres about ensuring that that the voices, that the experiences of women are heard in all these spaces.
But Tura Lewai says the male advocates want to stop being labeled as champions. He says the true champions are the women brave enough to flee from a violent situation or partner. This is Christine Ravoi, Nuaia.
A New Zealand Wellington city has become the first municipal body in the country to adopt a formal Pacifica policy analysis tool. The CASPA framework, as it's known, was developed by the Ministry for Pacific Peoples as a way for the government agencies to consider Pacific perspectives when developing policy. Local councillor Brian Dawson is part of the city's Pacific Advisory Group that helped implement the framework. He spoke to Dominic Godfrey about what CASPARA means for Wellington's Pacifica community.
This just gives us a tool that whenever we're taking a look at policy as a council, we can run it through this framework now to make sure, are we ticking these boxes? So we already have that. We're looking at things from a tangata whenua perspective, for example, and a mana whenua perspective. This gives us another opportunity to do that from a Pacifica perspective.
Give me an example of how it might work.
So a good example, I guess, a classic example that I'm working on right at the moment is our smoke-free policy for the city. And so, as we know, Wellington has a very low rate of smoking, relatively speaking, but the groups that don't include Pacifica young people. And so while we're putting our smoke-free policy together, we'll use the CASPARA framework to say, are we actually engaging properly with Pacifica peoples? Are we ensuring that we've ticked those boxes that need to be ticked to make sure that we are taking that specific population into account, particularly as in this case, it's a group that we do need to be focused on because they are adversely affected by it.
So making sure you're not alienating them, making sure you're speaking to them in appropriate language.
And that what we're doing, in particular that what we're doing that we think might be of assistance actually is of assistance. Because, you know, we can take educated guesses, but then there's always the danger that you're completely wrong. And so this gives us a framework to actually check our our assumptions at the door and really go in looking for facts.
Making sure that from the smoke-free perspective that the message is getting across to them there in the right way.
And also recognising, and you know, one of the challenges for us will be to make sure that we don't just use this framework for the obvious policy things, that we actually run all of our policy assumptions through it, because really, as local government, pretty much everything we do affects everybody, including Pacifica peoples. And Wellington in particular, yes, sporting heroes, Pacifica is outstanding, and we know that. The other area, of course, is arts and culture. You know, New Zealand has more opera singers per capita than anywhere else in the world, and a large percentage of those are actually Pacifica people. And Wellington is punching way above its weight class in that area as well. But actually, Pacifica people are active and involved in every aspect of Wellington's life, and therefore we need to make sure that we are ensuring that our policies accurately reflect Pacifica values and the Pacifican needs, but also that those needs and values have some influence on our decision-making.
Considering Auckland's the largest Pacifica city in the world, it's kind of surprising that they weren't first to the punch.
Yeah, well, you know, far be it from me to suggest that Wellington can usually beat Auckland at most things, and here's another example. I think we do have an advantage. We are, yes, Auckland is the largest Pacific city in the world, but it's a huge, sprawling area, and you know, no two parts talk to each other very well sometimes. We do have that advantage of being compact. Now, as far as Wellington City goes, Pacifica isn't a huge section of the population. It's about 5%. But, of course, regionally, that's a whole different story. So regionally, Pacifica people are very prominent in Wellington. And, you know, we're still small enough to be able to take that into account.
A church leader on Papua New Guinea's Manus Island says its reputation has been smeared and its people need to be compensated. Michael Kwana is a layman and spokesperson for the Catholic Diocese of Manus. Ben Robinson Drawbridge spoke to Mr. Kwan, who says the indefinite detention of refugees on the island has tarnished it in the eyes of the world.
Manusians are on the defensive. We are being labeled as a place that no one should visit. We have been smeared beyond all descriptions. This is no longer the paradise people know internationally. This is a place that has been tarnished because the Australian government dumped its responsibility on the island, and it has affected over or nearly 70,000 people on Manus. The problem now is the Manus people are now no longer good in the eyes of the world today because our island has been branded to be not a good place to be. Not the fault of the refugees. It's the fault of the Australian government who had decided to follow a Pacific solution.
What would the people of Manus like to see happen? How do they want their reputation to be restored?
The Australian government and its peoples must look at a gift package to compensate the Manus paradise, the Manus people of hospitalities, which only about 6 years ago were been branded out of that category. Australian government owed us a gift package, and I think this is their responsibility. And in part of that, they must come to help restore the image of the province. You see, the Australian government came around, they done this project, the Papua New Guinea government also agreed to that effect, and they are enjoying the so-called perks, privileges, and all that is under a special veil of secrecy. But exposed to the world right now is the Manus people being affected, like I said before.
Is there any particular assistance you think Australia needs to provide?
They have come in a small way. But the package that they have done in the last 6 years is for the rest of Papua New Guinea. For example, in the Papua New Guinea concept of project, they have listed like redoing the second biggest hospital in the country, Engau Inlay, and I think one or two projects of one or two of the universities, and also one to do with the road linking Lay and Medeng. Now, these are not in Manus. The Manus project allowed for a resealing of the road of some 36 kilometers, improvement of some schools, sealing of the town roads, building of the market, the police station in Manus, Now, these are part of the whole of Papua New Guinea put together for Manus. The amount is peanuts. It is peanuts. You look at an image being smeared, being tarnished, and it means they have a responsibility. It is a moral responsibility. It is a human responsibility that I believe that ought to come good.
Village in Samoa are fighting abuse on Facebook by enforcing hefty fines against people who post it. Experts say the move by village chiefs to curb harmful content on Facebook highlighted the growing problem the social media giant poses to Samoa. Mackenzie Smith reports.
In Lauli'i village, to the east of Samoa's capital Apia, locals have taken online policing into their own hands. Paramount Chief for Matu Samoa Oloanga Asuelu says it started when one of the village chiefs was abused on Facebook. For Matu Samoa told the Samoa Observer the comments were brought before the village council. There, in an unusual move for Samoa, the online discourse was met with punishment. Five families found responsible for the abuse were ordered to pay around $2,000 each. Experts say the moves will set a precedent for other villages in Samoa worried about online abuse. Fesola'i Alene Sofara is a law lecturer at the National University of Samoa.
Doing a lawsuit in a civil claim costs money and time-consuming, and might as well do it in this forum whereby the village council will impose those penalties on those families who are confirmed, simply because their names are on the Facebook and their comments.
Fesola'i says other villages have imposed similar bans in recent weeks as abuse via Facebook increases in Samoa. Earlier this month, the country's internet regulator said Pacific Island governments should pressure Facebook to crack down on fake news. But Fesola'i says people in Samoa aren't blaming the company, only how it's been used, hence the fines on individuals.
It's not that bad to put your opinion, but then to do and to make an abuse that belittles the village council and also defaming someone, well, I think the penalty is justified.
Glenn Finau, a PhD scholar at the University of New South Wales who specialises in cybercrime regulation, says the fines won't solve the problem.
It's not going to be a very feasible solution in the long term to curb what these people are actually trying to stop, which is, you know, criticism.
Mr. Finau says at the heart of the issue is a mismatch between traditional Samoan society and encroaching Western online platforms like Facebook.
Previously, traditionally, it was like, you know, you couldn't question the chief. But now, because, you know, what people are seeing is happening overseas, okay, well, yeah, we can question the chief and we can call him out if he's doing something wrong.
Despite the fines in Lauli'i village, it's unclear how they will be enforced, given that four of the five families live overseas. The fines are due to be paid by January 14. For Matu Samoa, the paramount chief says his village will take action against anyone abusing social media. This is Mackenzie Smith.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Scientists are cautiously optimistic about signs of resilience emerging in some corals despite adverse conditions. According to the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, global warming caused by climate change is creating hostile ocean environments that are killing or bleaching corals. This is bad because corals are seen as the foundation of marine ecosystems, much like trees are to forests. The coordinator of the administration's Coral Reef Watch, Mark Exton, says studies on the Great Barrier Reef in Australia show those corals that survive a major bleaching event in 2016 also lived through a second bleaching event in 2017. He told Corrie Hawkins that while this is good news, it doesn't necessarily mean corals are evolving.
You have to remember what we're talking about here is that, number one, as Terry Hughes, the lead author, has stated in the press release, dead corals don't bleach again. So that's a part of what you're seeing. The corals that are left after, or that were left after the 2016 bleaching event, were the survivors. They were the tough ones. So those were the corals that were better able to survive when the 2017 event came along.
So they might be sort of, because of like sort of natural selection, they are still as resilient last year as opposed to any sort of mutation. Is that what you're suggesting?
That's right. I mean, there's no indication here. There certainly is no mutation. We're not dealing with any new genes or anything of that sort. I mean, the corals that were around in 2017 were the ones that survived 2016.
And conditions are worsening. Is that the track that we're still on, or are they sort of, have they plateaued in the last year?
Well, the good news is 2018, there was no big bleaching event. 2019, we're still waiting to see. It's a kind of a touch-and-go situation right now with the El Nino that's forming. So it's not that things have plateaued. They got really bad during the 2015 and 2016 bleaching events on the GBR. But we're expecting it to come back like that. It's just going to be a matter of how long it is before the next really severe bleaching event. And you know, unfortunately, it's likely to be sooner rather than later.
And when you say GBR, you're talking about the Great Barrier Reef off of Australia, is that right?
Exactly, yes.
And I've seen there's some new science out about replanting corals. There's some new methods out. Is replanting any better of an option or at any scale that it could make an impact yet?
Well, you've just hit the big problem. It's scale. There are great efforts that are being made in the restoration world, the replanting of corals, and especially growing corals that are tougher. So not just growing back the same corals, but picking out ones that are doing better, crossing them with other corals that survived through a bleaching event, and you know, using those as the ones that you outplant when you do these sort of replanting efforts. But it's really something where the scale of everything that's being done is a portion of one reef on the Great Barrier Reef as compared to the couple of thousands of kilometers of reef that you're dealing with. And when you look at it on a global scale, it's even more of a drop in the bucket.
And remind us again why coral bleaching, why people should care that there's so much coral that's bleaching, and if there are any solutions or actions that could help make a difference going forward.
Well, the big action that we need to be taking is moving to a completely renewable energy economy. We need to move off of fossil fuels because it's the carbon dioxide that we're releasing into the atmosphere from burning of coal, burning of oil, burning of gas. The other heat-trapping gases, even from the release of methane when natural gas leaks, that's what's causing the climate change, and there's no question about that. So that's something that we have to address no matter what we do. Bleaching then happens as a result of the warming that comes from climate change. So as water temperatures rise, the temperatures get too warm, it breaks down the relationship between the coral animal and the microscopic algae living inside their tissues. That means that they're now bleached. They're white in color. You can see right through the clear tissue to the skeleton underneath. They're not dead yet, but they are starving. They're sick, and they're more susceptible to disease. So this is a major impact to an important ecosystem that supports a half a billion to a billion people's primary food source, along with being worth about $9 trillion globally in terms of their ecosystem services.
The fight against dengue fever in the Pacific has gone aerial with the first trial using a drone to release bacteria-carrying mosquitoes in Fiji. A remote-controlled helicopter was used to drop the mosquitoes carrying Wachabaya bacteria in the capital as part of trials to protect the communities from dengue, Zika. The project is being piloted by the World Mosquito Program and internationally non-profit company We Robotics. Fiji project coordinator Amenistade Tuviolo tells Christina Rovi that the trial in its early stages has the potential to release mosquitoes with the bacteria across many dengue-infected areas.
We conducted this drone release of Wolbachia carrying mosquitoes.
Can you explain this new technology that you're using?
The use of an unmanned aerial vehicle to release mosquitoes with naturally occurring bacteria called Wolbachia. It is the first time World Mosquito Program is using this safe, non-invasive method of releasing Wolbachia mosquitoes using UAV technology.
How are these mosquitoes going to be released? How is it going to be done?
In this part of the project, we are using drone to release Wolbachia carrying mosquitoes from above. Eh? So basically, we put them to sleep, the mosquitoes, in cooler. Under 4 degrees Celsius, then we pack them into a canister. So there are 4 canisters, and then they are inserted into the drones, and then we fly the drone. So basically, the idea is to release them. We have plotted the release site. It's also programmed into the drone. The drone has all the release points programmed into it. So as soon as the drone reaches that site, from releases mosquitoes. And when the mosquitoes are released from above at a certain height or altitude, maybe they are awoken again because of the warmth and the temperature, the difference in temperature. Most of them will start to fly again.
The whole point of the trial is to release these mosquitoes to breed with the wild population and hopefully decrease the dengue virus that's in the wild population.
Exactly. So they basically mate with the wild ones, and then the bacteria passes on to their offspring.
One of the breakthroughs at this year's meeting of the Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission in Hawaii was moved to improve the welfare of ships' crews. The body, also known as the Tuna Commission, is made up of the distant water fishing nations and the Pacific Island countries, in whose water most of the world's tuna are caught. Improving conditions for crews was just one of the several issues in which the Pacific region felt it made some progress. Often these summits are fictitious, but this time it seems there was a lot of agreement, as Bubba Cook of the World Wildlife Fund for Nature told Don Wiseman.
I think so. I think we hit a turning point this year in the ability of the commission to make decisions. It seemed as though there was a lot more of a conciliatory theme throughout the entire meeting, and there was a lot more effort, I think, to try and genuinely reach compromise. It's always a challenge in a consensus-based system because the inevitable trend is to carry things toward the least common denominator and to heavily dilute what would be very good provisions. And to some degree, that happened with certain provisions, but overall, I think the outcome was generally positive.
It does seem, though, that mostly it's everything's in a bit of a holding pattern.
That is true with respect to tropical tunas. But what we did see, for instance, is some very good initiatives move forward, particularly with respect to establishing a target reference point for South Pacific albacore, which by doing so, it allows us to now look at some of the other stocks and establishing similar limits for those stocks, particularly big eye and yellowfin tuna. And we saw the establishment of a crew welfare resolution, which it's the first RFMO that has taken steps to establish worker protections and crew welfare protections around the world. So it's not an insignificant thing that they took that step to do that.
They haven't laid out precisely how they'll go about that process, though, have they?
It is just a resolution at this point, but I think there's very strong motivation. Some of the statements from many of the countries around the table, they showed their intent to go further and that they viewed this as a first step and that the next steps are going to be putting concrete measures in place to actually address these issues on the water.
How confident are you that all of the distant water fishing nations buy into this and that they won't just blithely go away and do what they want?
I think that the noose is tightening on some of the bad activity. There's been so much more exposure in the media and investigative reports, you know, a number of high-profile court cases and recorded instances of crew abuse and neglect and even slavery. So I don't think they can ignore the issue anymore, and as a result, the islands see it as an opportunity not only to address what is a human rights issue and a matter of just pure justice, but also in doing so, make those jobs more receptive and more available to the Pacific Island people. You know, one of the reasons that the Pacific Islanders don't take these positions is because these vessels, they're terrible. I mean, you go to Suva Harbor and you see some of the longline vessels from China and Chinese Taipei that are heavily rusted, heavily listing, they're floating death traps. And who would want to work on one of those vessels? So by raising the standard throughout the Pacific and throughout the world, for that matter, we're creating employment opportunities for others in the Pacific Islands as well. So I think it's really, there's a lot of factors at play. And I think that this measure, this resolution that's been put forward and the motivation of the Pacific Islands to make it stronger is going to bode well for the future for fisheries in the Pacific. I don't think that the distant water fleets will be able to hold out on this issue because it, as a matter of human rights, it's something that's very difficult to argue against.
In terms of the wider efforts to control IUU fishing, do you think there are still, well, are there rogue nations who just go about doing what they want and ignoring the rules?
Well, I think we do have evidence that there are certain countries that are non-compliant more often than others. And I think that we certainly see a correlation between illegal fishing and illegal drug trafficking and other illegal activities and human rights abuses. I think that's pretty well evidenced. And that results from the ability of vessels and individuals running these vessels, the captains and the owners, to avoid detection. And one of the ways that they're able to do that is through high seas transshipment, which allows them to avoid any kind of monitoring or control in port. So if by having that mechanism available, they can keep the longline vessels out for as much as 2 years, doing at-sea replenishments and not allowing the crews to come to shore. And because it happens on the high seas outside the eyes of those who might want to know, they're able to get away with whatever they want. So I think those factors are going to play an important role in not just addressing the crew welfare issue, but addressing some of the broader issues of illegality.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Thank you for listening. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Just a quick reminder that listeners in the Pacific can catch a 3x daily edition of the program. So until next time, I'm Keith Pelham, wishing you well, saying so long, and take care.